work infrastructure work in this country.
Okay, well, I'm glad to know that if I ask you what you think we should do, you're not making shadow puppets on the radio. You've got a program, and there's plenty that we can do, and that's another thing that people don't understand. People
get out, like, 10 seconds.
Anyway, we're out. Bruce, thank you. Thanks to all of your people, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes here on the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon, originating from WPFW in Washington, D.C. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the participating organizations or the originating and affiliated radio stations.
This is WHFR Dearborn at 89.3, also online at WHFR.FM, making waves.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon on the Pacifica Radio Network, coming from WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Welcome to the 20th anniversary edition of the Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty. Presented in conjunction with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, the Poor People's March on Washington, and WPFW, your station for jazz and justice in Washington, D.C. The number to call in is 1-866-LEFT-OUT.
1 minute left and 20 out. Seconds.
That's 866-533-8688. Live video of the broadcast may be found at homelessnessmarathon.org.
Hi, my name is Galen Tyler. I'm from Philadelphia, and I've been on the march from June 2nd to arriving today and yesterday in Washington, D.C. I've been on this march,
seconds.
You know, to kind of highlight, you know what I mean, the issues that's been directly affecting poor people across this country, and to show that poor people can lead this movement and they must be sitting at the table if we're going to come up with solutions. It's a very, very big problem in this country around people not having a right to food, clothing, housing, health care, and education, and a job that pays a livable wage. And
seconds.
With that big problem, we're going to need a big solution. And that big solution is going to be have to be very inclusive and have to include people that are being directly affected by these different issues. It can't come from the top up. It has to come from where people are working together to ensure that these issues are very addressed properly, and so that they're long sustaining, not just a quick fix, not just a band-aid, but a long sustaining solution, you know what I mean, that allows us to have a future for our kids and our grandkids in this country.
That was a voice from the Poor People's March on Washington, currently in D.C. right as we speak. Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating from Washington, D.C., where our host is WPFW, your jazz and justice station. Here with me in the studio, I have Penny Callen, who is a speaker advocate, and Megan Hustings, who is the interim director for the National Coalition for the Homeless. Penny and Megan, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hey, Jeremy.
Hello. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, it's our honor and our pleasure. And on the line, we also have Paul Bowden, who is the field director for the Western Regional Advocacy Project. Paul, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, all right. Well, I'm glad to have all three of you here. Paul, let me start with you, because I know you've got less time. Tell us, the Western Regional Advocacy Project is active in how many states?
In Colorado, California, and Oregon. So it'd be three states where we have active membership.
And what exactly are you fighting for?
The decriminalization of poverty and of homeless people and of poor people, and the restoration of a our colonization days has a long history of picking certain segments of our communities that local governments decide they want to get rid of. Sundown towns, Jim Crow, Japanese American Exclusion Act, Bossarero Treaty, ugly laws. Today we're targeting homeless people. But homeless people weren't the first targets of these laws. Were standing still, sitting down, laying down, eating, being in town after dark. They call it now camping. These become criminal activities that get selectively enforced against segments of the community they want to leave and get the hell out of their towns. And they enforce these laws aggressively, and that's what we're opposing. That's what we're against. And we don't want to just end it for homeless people today. We want to end it once and for all.
Paul, let me ask Megan here a question. Thank you for that. Megan, is Paul just some kind of crackpot out there on the West Coast, or from your national perspective, have you seen these issues outside of the states that he mentioned?
Of course I'm a crack.
I was going to say that, Paul. No, this is happening everywhere. It's not just the West Coast. I think things recently have been more pronounced on the West Coast, and there's been a little bit more media coverage of goings-on, especially encampments and other things in California. But no, it's the same situation across the country. There's just not enough resources, affordable housing, shelter, you name it, for the number of people who are struggling to get by.
Penny, you're a formerly homeless woman,
yes,
as I understand it. Did you ever encounter any issues of criminalization? Were you on the street? Were you harassed? What have you ever intersected with this issue?
Not in that way, but when it came time to leave a shelter and I still didn't have a place to go, I only needed one more night, they still called the police to have me leave, and I refused to leave, so I was arrested for not leaving the shelter.
And you had a place to go if you had one more night there. So
yes.
In other words, your alternative was the street for a night.
Yes.
And they were going to still call the police on you.
Yes.
Because they weren't really, it's not such a forgiving system is the point.
No.
Yeah, no.
Paul, if you had your druthers, now what are the things that you want to see enacted as opposed to the situation that we have now?
I want to see a government that feels that healthcare, education, housing, and since we're a capitalist system, a living income is a necessity, is a human right, is a good thing. Like, why would a government not feel that the healthcare needs, the education, a smart, educated, healthy, well-housed community membership is a good thing? We think it's a great thing for homeowners. We do $144 billion a year in housing subsidies for home ownership programs, but we feel like it's a charity and a drain and a hazard to possibly feel that poor people have a right to a place to live.
Well, what is it? What about when they say, oh, we just can't afford that? The government doesn't have enough money in its budget. What's your answer to that?
That's BS. They're totally BSing us. I was just up in Eureka. That's where I'm coming down from, and I might be even, we may drop each other again like I got dropped earlier because I'm in the middle of the Redwoods getting back home. But last night at the Poor People's Campaign sleep out at the courthouse in Eureka, a woman that didn't know her way around with a couple of people in the car, like they claim drove erratically, they got jacked up, guns pointed at them, handcuffed. One person got arrested for a bench warrant. And this was strictly about trying to make sure that the homeless and poor people that were sleeping out at the courthouse knew damn well that these six cop cars that came in over somebody trying to find a place to park was a symbol. You guys ain't one of us. You need to get the hell out of Eureka, California.
Wow. And just to explain, the Poor People's Campaign that you're referring to is this thing that Reverend Barber, New Poor People's Campaign, is in, Liz Theo Harris, she's also a reverend. That's a separate entity from the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, but they're being very active right now, and they're active, I take it, on the West Coast as well.
Yeah, they're pretty active around the country, and it's separate in name and in structure, but the goals are the same. And, mm-hmm. Sherry and those guys in Kensington Welfare Rights, they've been pushing under this banner for a long time, and it shouldn't be about the banner. Because when you look at what those guys have been pushing for out of Philly and their whole membership throughout the country, of which I'm proud to be a strong supporter of, this is what we need to be doing. We need to be building power, not asking. You know, Malcolm X says it really well. Power sees nothing without a demand, but you don't get a demand without building that power. That's what we've spent the last couple of days up here in Northern California. Rural communities get screwed over. The cops think nobody's watching. They don't get the media attention that the big cities get. And the brutality and the in-your-face, get the hell out of here, is brutal. And
yeah,
it's going to take organizing to fight back.
Well, let me turn to Megan here and ask Megan, in terms of, I've been doing this a while, Paul's been doing this even longer, and you've been in this field for a while. Is the climate changing for the better or for the worse, and how do you see that?
That's always a tough question.
Yeah, well, why do you think you're here?
Well, yeah, you know, I think it's there might be a few ways in which it's better. You know, we are getting a little bit more media coverage, a little bit more kind of public discussion about, you know, these issues that Paul's talking about, the incredible dehumanization and criminalization of poor people. However, the government side of things, the solution side is just, it's kind of getting worse. Mm-hmm. You know, we still are fighting on the federal level. Every single budget cut, every single program that actually helps people survive is on the chopping block. And so we're just fighting to maintain the levels of funding that we have now when we need actually a lot more.
Yeah, we have to stress the levels of funding now are the levels that have kept people on the street.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And they've just remained, you know, pretty flat over the last few years. And but we need more. And it doesn't, you know, in terms of the overall federal budget, it's not a huge, it's a drop in the bucket. It would make a massive difference in our communities.
Penny, let me ask you, okay, how long ago was it that you became homeless?
I became homeless in 1990, and I was homeless for 10 years.
Uh-huh. Now, I've had people on this show talking, and we will have somebody actually on from Finland later, but I've had people on from Denmark, Switzerland. Things are very different. And I know this sounds funny, but in those countries, if you've got a problem with keeping your housing, you go to an office and you get help. Okay. Have you found, in your general estimation, our government has been helpful to you in your struggle, or how helpful has it been?
Well, actually, my story is a lot different, you know.
Well, let's just hear your story then, because some people do get help. Let's hear it.
Well, like I said, I was homeless for 10 years, and it ended up being more of a blessing in disguise for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because ever since I was 6 years old, I've had a variety of different traumatic events, you know, from my mom, my father dying, to being molested at 10 years old, to being raped at 13 and running away from home, and just in and out of domestic violence relationships and mental health, you know, stuff started, you know, because post-traumatic stress disorder from the traumatic events.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically how I became homeless when I was like 30 years old.
And the government did or did not help you with that?
They didn't. And I didn't know to even try to get help from the government at that time either.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it wasn't like it was easy for you to access services, go to an office somewhere and say, I need help. That wasn't easy for you.
No. You know, I had to ask other homeless people, you know, for whatever help.
And what got you out of homelessness in the end?
Doing a lot of work on myself, you know, mentally and emotionally, and also educational.
And then you got a job, or you got assistance?
Well, I had gotten not only a job where I worked at for 2 years at the Pentagon, but I also got my housing where I've been at for almost 18 years come August.
Oh my gosh, I better talk to you respectfully if you're associated with the Pentagon. Not that I would be disrespectful anyway.
Only 2 years I've worked there.
Oh, that scares me.
Yeah.
Paul, do you want to tell us something a little bit about the cutbacks we're facing, the prospects of what's going to happen to what little programs that we have out there?
Yeah, but I also would say from the days I was in the street in the 80s and got started in this stuff, it's 10 times worse in terms of alternatives to sleeping outside. The shelter system has become an industry with homeless management information systems and coordinated intake and motivational case management, as if the problem of homelessness is dysfunctional human beings. as opposed to a dysfunctional system. And that has become an industry. And the National Alliance to End Homelessness and these other groups are out there making buck.
Yeah, we, around here we refer to the National Alliance as Satanists, basically.
Well,
you know,
but, you know, and then when you look at poverty systems, going back to the war on poverty, with when we created 501c3 nonprofits and we created schools of social work, you know, the problem of poverty is racism and classism. It's not dysfunctional people who end up poor. Or the problem of homelessness is a dysfunctional housing system. Nothing ends homelessless like a home. You know, the
what a funny concept.
You know, I lost my mom at a young age and ended up out in the street. That's been happening to people forever.
Right.
But that didn't lead to millions of people sleeping out in the streets every night. You know, so you got to separate out what's real issues that human beings go through, and how do we create a humane response to those issues, like domestic violence, where when we did the Violence Against Women Act, we ended up closing a bunch of domestic violence shelters and making them homeless programs. That's asinine.
Right.
There should always be, unfortunately, you know, racism pre-exists the early 80s, classism pre-exists the early 80s. Homelessness is a manifestation of not addressing these systemic issues.
Let me tell everybody out there that the number to call in here on the Homelessness Marathon, the 20th Homelessness Marathon, is 866-LEFT-OUT, which is 866-533-8688. But, Paul, what in specific? I mean, here is the Trump administration has come in, and a lot of people are not familiar. Megan alluded to their proposing cutbacks, but a lot of people are not familiar with what that means. What does that mean in practice that they're talking about doing?
What it means is that the United States government is getting out of the business of housing as an issue that they control for people that are poor, and saying that all housing, with the low-income housing tax credit program, with RAD, where they're mortgaging off public housing units, that it's a commodity. And when you take the Reaganomics neoliberal BS from 1980 and you look at what's happened since then, Democrat or Republican administrations, it's that the Reagan mantra of government's incompetent, government's bad, let the private sector handle everything in our lives, our schools, our housing, our health care, that those are all commodities. And those should be controlled, and government should only give tax credits and tax breaks to corporations to run those systems because government is incompetent. Well, we need to start saying it's our freaking government, and government needs to do what we demand, not make profits for businesses. And Trump is a perfect manifestation of the 30 years, 35, 40 years of Reaganomics and neoliberal economics, and that's where we need to marshal all of our resources and include our artists and our lawyers and our organizers and listen to the voices and the priorities of poor and homeless people and start demanding that our government address those issues.
While we're talking about Trump, it's probably worth mentioning that he had a face-to-face sit-down with a leader of North Korea, but he hasn't had a face-to-face sit-down with a homeless person who's an American yet. So we have a caller on the line. That number is 866-LEFT-OUT or 866-533-8688. We have Mark from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Mark, to the Homelessness Marathon.
Ah, how are you guys doing this afternoon?
Well, we're having a good time.
Mm-hmm, I think so.
I hear you. Hey, so I had a real quick question. I'm hearing a whole lot of complaining and what the government hasn't done, but I'd like to bring up the name J.K. Rowling to everybody. She was homeless while writing the Harry Potter novel and then had them published as a homeless person. The only thing holding the homeless community back is the homeless themselves. Now, I will agree there are a couple of people out there that have major issues, and maybe shutting down the mental health programs back when Reagan was around was a bad idea. But it's not because the government hasn't done anything for them. It's not because of your skin color that you don't have certain things. It's because you're not willing to get up and do it for yourself.
All right. Let me, Penny, toss that to you. You're shaking your head. You've been homeless. Is that because you were lazy and waited for the government to do things for you?
No, it's not. There's a lot of times that, you know, social workers, they didn't even know, you know, the other resources out there. There are so many people that I have talked to in the 10 years that I was homeless, and also continue to talk to. And not only do they have severe mental health issues, so I kind of agree there, but there's just so many people that have given up on themselves. You know, so it's not really the government, you know. So, yeah, I agree, but I also disagree.
There is, well, first of all, everybody agrees that to the extent that we're able to exercise it, we have personal responsibility. Yeah. And if we have some reason why we can't, we're disabled or whatever, that's different. But, Mark, let me point out to you. Are you still there, Mark?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Wait, Mark. Let me just point one thing out to you because, you know, a lot of people believe what you believe, but they also, it's a very narrow vision of what the government's role is. The government's role is not just with programs. It's the government that sets employment policies. It's the government that sets the minimum wage. It's the government that sets housing policies. So you have a city like San Francisco where full-time employed people can't remotely afford to live in that city. And it used to be different many years ago. Working people used to be able to live in that city. Yeah. That is a product of government policy, which has nothing to do with homelessness or anti-poverty policy. It has to do with letting the real estate developers run amok.
Okay, so let's go back to Steve for a second. Steve went out on a job and worked for 6 weeks without a paycheck. I don't care how long I've been working for somebody. If you tell me that I got to go 6 weeks without a paycheck, I'm going to think something's up, because I'm going to be like, well, you know, that's not going to keep the electric bill on for my wife while I'm down there, you know.
Mark, you're certainly right about that. But sometimes what if that's the only chance you have for a job and you just got to keep at it and hope that it works out?
Then I got to go look for something else. I got to work 2 or 3 jobs.
Okay, Mark. Thank you very much for the call. Certainly you speak for a lot of people. Megan, do you want to address any of these concerns?
Well, yes. I mean, I would say that it sounds, with all due respect, Mark, that perhaps you
He's off the line now, but go ahead and talk to him.
You haven't listening. Had to struggle yourself to survive. I mean, these, Jeremy mentioned the minimum wage. I mean, the value of the federal minimum wage has dropped significantly since it was set. There are people who are working 40 hours a week and can't afford basic housing. In fact, the National Low Income Housing Coalition has just come out with their new out of reach report that looks at the cost of housing, and there's no county, there's no city in the country where you can work 40 hours a week at the federal minimum wage and actually be able to afford the average rent on a 2-bedroom apartment for your family. So it's not about people not working or not trying hard. It's about you know, the systems, our economic system, our you know, the government systems, the whole economics of the country that are just not working for a large majority of people.
But, you know, we all agree, right? I mean, that people have personal responsibility, but they have to exercise it within the context of the society they're in. For instance, if you're a soldier on a battlefield, you have personal responsibility, but the situation is there's people shooting bullets at you. That's not an everyday situation. You're not necessarily, not everybody can cope with that. Not everybody will survive it. Same with homelessness. Paul, would you like to weigh in on this?
Well, I mean, I'm not organizing with communities to create a nanny state and to create somebody to serve us and do for us. I'm looking for parity. If housing is a value to the United States government, to the extent that they subsidize home ownership to the tune of $144 billion a year with no screening criteria, anybody who qualifies, doesn't matter your past record, whether you've had a felony, doesn't matter what country you were born in. If you're paying a mortgage, the government subsidizes your housing because of the fact that that money primarily goes to mortgage companies. But they clearly see that housing is a value, and they subsidize the hell out of it. When that housing is for poor people, they screen the hell out of it. We have waiting lists. They're tearing it down, and there's less and less of it available for people that need it.
Paul, explain that to people. Just explain that one point, because people don't get it necessarily. When you're saying they're subsidizing homeowners, you're talking about the tax deduction for mortgage payments and things?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And I'm talking about all tax deductions that homeowners get. and it's administered by the IRS. There's no intake process. There's no screening process. There's no waiting list. There's nobody coming and counting toothbrushes in your bathroom to see who's living there. There's no rules around who can crash at your house or not.
No drug
testing.
There's
none of that. And it's $144 billion a year that we spend subsidizing that type of housing. And that's because of who benefits from those subsidies. But for poor people, we say we can't afford it. They need to get off their asses and they need to go work. Well, you know what? Most poor people are working. And nobody's looking for the nanny state. We're looking for parity, we're looking for equality, and we're looking to be treated as human beings by our government. Why wouldn't a government want to see the people being governed healthy, educated, and well-housed? Why is that considered communist or socialist or lazy? You know, we give tax breaks to rich people that's never worked a day in their lives. We don't mind doing that, but we won't give a benefit or a helping hand to people who are working their butts off and can't afford a place to live.
Well, you know, you make a point.
That's not about help me. It's about treat me equally the same way you treat everyone else, especially those that are rich.
Well,
and, you know, we're pretty freaking safe from invasion in Canada. So maybe we can look at our military budget and say, is this really helping us? Is this really protecting us? And do we need to spend 10, 20 times on our military-industrial complex because it benefits major corporations as we spend on providing care for senior citizens that need a place to live?
Well, Paul, I'm ready to start the Count the Toothbrushes of the Rich movement here. I thought you had a good point there. I know you have limited time. Are you still able to stay with us, or do I have to sign off with you now, Paul?
I can stay as long as the cell connection works.
Okay. All right. Very good.
I pulled over on the side of the road, so I'm okay, as long as I don't get hit.
All right. Well, good. I'm glad. Yes, we hope you don't get hit, Paul, right on the air. Bad idea.
It makes a good rating.
Only if I can advertise it in advance, Paul. We'll say, come listen, and then we'll hear a man getting hit. Never mind. We're not going to do that. The number here to call in, which I will advertise, is 866-LEFT-OUT. That's 866-533-8688. Megan, what do you have to say about this issue of government responsibility versus personal responsibility? This is certainly, Mark, who brought this up, he's not the first to bring this up. I mean, this is a real issue. You hear it every day. So what would be the National Coalition for the Homeless's point of view on that, or yours?
Well, no, honestly, I think that this is at the heart of the issue. Why we have homelessness today is because, like Paul said, as a country right now, we don't really believe that housing, that a livable income, that healthcare, that these things are actually human rights. Most of the world thinks that these are human rights. We're one of the very few, pretty much the only developed nation that has not signed on to some pretty standard
healthcare, for instance, right?
Yeah. These internationally held, values of basic human rights, basic human necessities. So, a lot of the work that we do is spent doing public education, is trying to educate people about, well, this is what homelessness is actually like, and this is why people fall into it, and this is how awfully they're treated while they are homeless.
It's worth pointing out that just a few decades ago, you could get a free higher education in the United States, and a lot of wonderful people were able to do that. And I don't remember we had Karl Marx on the dollar bill back then. This was still a capitalist country. Mm-hmm. So people should understand that even within the terms of how our country is structured, the system that we operate on, things have gotten much worse than they were just a few decades ago.
Yeah.
That number to call in again is 866-LEFT-OUT, which is 866-533-8688. And on the line we have Burke from Overland Park, Kansas. Burke, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for calling. What's on your mind, Burke?
I was wondering what guests and host thoughts were on, it's kind of been touched on a little bit, but just like broadly, government funding for homelessness, for drugs and mental health issues, housing, all these things, over the last 30 to 35 years, as your guests have pointed out, how they've crumbled. It's beginning to seem, and then with Trump to boot, and the very far right controlling all branches of government, it seems a lot to me like passive eugenics and almost a Third Reichish mentality of let people suffer, let them die, so the rich can get richer, and so the population dwindles. I mean, maybe I'm missing something, maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but it very much scares me, and it should scare everyone else.
Burke, let me turn that over. Megan, what do you have to say to that?
Well, so yesterday I was participating in the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival, so different from the Poor People. Because
right, we're trying to keep them straight. Campaign. Same cause.
But one thing that stood out was that while there was a larger group of people doing civil disobedience, there was a smaller group of faith leaders who went up to the Supreme Court steps and stood in a circle. There were nine of them, and they started praying. After maybe half an hour of praying, they were asked to leave. They weren't moving. They were arrested. Actually, they're still in jail, as far as I know. And immediately after they were taken away, there were tourists up and down the stairs of the Supreme Court. No problems. You know, loitering, taking pictures. You know, taking whatever time they could. So, you know, I try to keep. I would prefer not to go to that place of. You know, more conspiracy theory, thinking that it is some kind of passive eugenics, but it's hard not to, you know, and when you think about just the overall numbers of people who are currently homeless, who are on the steps of being homeless, you know, it's the growing inequality between, you know, the rich and everybody else, basically, it's hard to see that, that there is going to be parity unless we all stand up and we make our voices heard. And there is some of that going on. I think that we have to all take responsibility for ourselves, and that we have to ensure that this is a participatory democracy, and that we all vote, and that we all hold our elected officials accountable to provide for the basic human necessities that we all need.
Burke, I want to thank you very much for the call. You have a last comment you want to make?
Yeah, I just wondered if maybe people thought that part of the problem and getting some of these solutions taken care of, going back to the 501c3 stuff, corporations, et cetera, it's like the majority is suffering from this delusion, like I call it like the Batman delusion. Some rich, generous, big-hearted Koch brother or Bill Gates is going to come and solve all the world's ills with their private money that they inherited by their own hard work and choice, which is total BS to begin with. But just the narrative that is driven home so much is that somebody other than the government will always take care of this for you. It's going to be a corporation, it's going to be a private individual, but the government's bad government.
Burke, thank you so much for the call. I want to note, by the way, I mean, personally, I'm on the same wavelength there, because I noticed what's-her-name Kardashian got somebody pardoned and recently. Well, it's getting to be like you have to go talk to the nobility, like we're in a feudal society. Maybe Sure. Maybe Prince so-and-so will help you out. Mm-hmm. We got to keep moving here. Eric from Alexandria, Virginia, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
How you doing?
Good. Well, what's on your mind, Eric?
Hey, my thing, I heard this gentleman telling people to get off their butt and work. And it's a mind blower, because I'm just listening to C-SPAN yesterday. We spent $9 billion with a B in Afghanistan to rebuild it. $9 billion. Now, that's the craziest ever to me. If you ask me, how come we can't spend that here and help our own? Because, yeah, a smart nation is a good nation. And, you know, a healthy nation is a great nation. And that's all I got to say, buddy. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Eric. On the line, everybody hang on. We got our second guest for this hour, who is Amanda Brown Hunter, and I'm sure she's going to have a lot to say, from Amarillo, Texas. Amanda, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Amanda, you are currently in a tent city in Amarillo. Is that correct?
I don't live there. I started one.
Okay, so tell us the story about the tent. You used to live in it, right?
No, I've actually never been homeless.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood that, but you founded this tent city. Tell us the story about it.
I had started feeding for a group here called Amarillo Brown Bag Runs, and we would go and feed the homeless every day. And there was one particular group that we called the Ice House Camp, and it was probably about 30 individuals who were living in tents, campers, whatever they could manage. And the city had decided to start enforcing a no camping ordinance and sent the police in to, you know, evict them and bring in the boom trucks and destroy all of their things.
Now, were these people doing, committing, were they doing anything wrong?
No. I mean, they were just trying to live.
Mm-hmm.
So, I had begun talking to them and developing relationships with them. And so I began asking them, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to go to the shelters? And that's whenever they started telling me all the different reasons why they don't utilize the shelters. And quite frankly, all of them were very valid reasons, such as being separated from your spouse. I wouldn't mm-hmm. want to be separated from my spouse or children. And, you know, mm-hmm. just the reasons are endless. And so we started talking and decided, well, what if we could find private land? So I went out and found private land and rented it for us to stay on. And that's how Christchurch Camp and New Beginnings was born.
Mm. And so how, you made a deal with a landowner, as I understand it, who allowed and it was okay with him to have homeless people on his land.
Yes.
So it wasn't like you were sneaking on somebody's land and doing some horrible thing. It was, everybody was copacetic with it.
Yes. I was upfront with everything from the beginning. And he agreed to it. And so we set up camp and started a nonprofit.
And Amarillo, the city of Amarillo then said to you, hey, that's wonderful. You're helping us take care of this problem. You've got homeless people there. We're off the streets. We congratulate you and we support you. Is that what happened?
No, not at all. The city at first didn't actively work against me, but they were definitely not working with me either. They said, everything's fine as long as I stay up to code. So they would come out. We started November 4th, and by the end of November, they had come out and started, you know, telling me, okay, you're going to have to get porta potties. You're going to have to do this. You're going to have to do this. Everything they told me that, you know, we had to do, we got to it absolutely as quickly as we could, usually within 24 hours. And then the harassment continued even after I got up to code, to where we had people who would leave their excess bicycle parts out around their tents. Well, they said that wasn't okay, that it was a harborage for rats. So they would put them inside these little tents to where they would have them organized. They weren't out in the open, and that still wasn't good enough for the city. During the holidays, where everybody is exceptionally generous, we had tons of different groups coming in, bringing donations and food, and getting to know our residents, you know, really changing their perception on what they thought homelessness was and who the homeless were. But during that time, of course, we didn't have any extra dumpsters. We had two dumpsters on the street that we would try to throw the leftover trash and things like that in. And they were always overflowing. Well, the city started citing us for that. So we asked the city if we could get larger dumpsters or if we could even get the dumpsters that were there emptied more often. And we were told things such as they can't allocate tax dollars to such a venture. And, you know, to where I had to provide dumpsters, too. You know, they weren't going to make it easy on me whatsoever. And
we should just point out quickly that actually, from a city's point of view, it's cheaper to provide dumpsters than to provide homeless services. So,
well, perhaps.
Would generally think so.
Yeah. Megan, you want to say what?
The cities like L.A. are spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on cleaning up encampments right now instead of housing people. So, you know.
Yeah. But it's cheaper to give a dumpster to an encampment than if it's a good one, right, than it is to put people in housing. I mean, we're not talking about the gold-plated solution here. All they were asking for was a dumpster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
Well, see, our city had set up a couple of years ago a board to try to be proactive in how we deal with the homeless. And but they also stated that, you know, it would cost upwards of $1 million plus in order to do this low barrier shelter. Well, I did it on my own and I didn't cost the city a dime.
Right. Paul, let me ask you, have you heard this story, anything like it before, where people are voluntarily taking responsibility as citizens and they've put together a tent encampment and everybody's doing okay and they're being responsible and they're not trying to be a burden to the government? And yet it's, oh, Paul is gone. We've lost Paul. I'm talking to Paul and he's not there. I'm sorry to hear that. He warned us we might drop him. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, getting out of the shelters, and you've actually been in one, right?
Yes, I've been in several shelters.
And were they wonderful places to be?
For me, they were. There's maybe a few horror stories, you know, that I've kind of witnessed, and other people, you know, they talk about the horror stories, but I didn't see the bed bugs. I may have seen the rats or the mice or something. But like I said before, it was more of a blessing in disguise for me.
For you personally.
Yeah.
But let me just ask you this. From your point of view and from what you've seen, can you understand why people would say, I'd rather be in a tent city with people in a similar situation on a landowner who welcomes us there, that would be preferable to being in a shelter? There'd be a reason for that.
Oh, definitely, yes, because they do separate families.
They throw you out and stuff in the morning. You can't just lie around. I don't mean like lazily. I mean, you can't, even if you're sick, you can't stay in the
shelter. Well, there's one shelter that's 24 hours, but now you still have to get out during the day.
So you ain't like you're out by 7 or 6 or 7, and then you can't get back in. And not the way people normally live. So, Amanda, what happened to this thing? The city was there. They were talking about bicycle parts. They were talking about this. They were talking about that. And what was the upshot?
Well, we came up to code with everything they had asked for. And so whenever they couldn't get rid of us by making us come up to that code aspect, they suddenly found this ordinance that goes back to the 1980s. That says there's no, you can't erect a shelter for more than 72 hours at a time. So that was on February 14th, that was basically their card to get rid of us. Because if we did not leave within a certain amount of time, we would start receiving the fines of up to $2,000 a day per person per violation.
So they forced you out, basically.
Yes, they disbanded us. We found another lady to rent us property, and we were going to take down the tents every 3 days and then stick them back up, you know, an inconvenience but doable. Well, the city told us that wouldn't work. And so I went and found other land to rent, and we had been hiding there for a couple of months before the city found us. And after the city found us, they didn't have our permission to come on land. We had no trespassing, everything like that. So they used a game warden to illegally gain access to the land so that they could say that they saw this violation or this violation. And so then they started sending this property owner notices that we had to be gone.
Megan, you wanted to say?
Well, you know, there's just so much of this. It seems really backwards that a lot of cities are spending almost more time trying to figure out how to interrupt people's daily survival acts than to figure out how to house them.
Megan, one of the things that I was hoping you would do here while we're talking to you is, can you give us a thumbnail, a brief portrait of who homeless people are statistically across the board? Are they all drug addicts? Are there no exceptions? I see you, Penny, are shaking your head. And I mean, I'm being facetious, but...
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah, this is one of the questions that we answer all the time. I mean, Penny, yeah.
Well, who's homeless in America?
Anybody can be homeless.
Yeah. But I mean, do we have any... what percentage are children? What percentage are employed? Do we know that?
Well, I hate to talk about numbers because numbers are a huge problem, period. But
and they're all inaccurate. But what should we think?
Maybe around a quarter of people who experience homelessness do so because of mental illness or because of substance abuse issues. What we see a lot of times is that actually those mental health issues and substance abuse problems come up after someone
I've seen
homeless.
That with my own eyes. Yeah.
It's a homelessness itself is a traumatic experience.
Correct. Yeah.
So, you know, about 40% of the homeless population are families who have children, many of whom are headed by single mothers or just headed by the mother. There are about a quarter of the homeless population, or what's known as chronically homeless, have been on the streets for a very long time, and suffer some of those harder disabilities to get over, harder things that keep them on the streets. And then most of the population, the rest is known as episodically homeless, people who go in and out, you know, work jobs, they get evicted because they miss a payment or two on the rent, and they're back on the streets, and then they finally find a landlord who's willing to rent to them. It's usually probably a pretty bad landlord, and they might go in and out of places or staying with friends and family. I talk about numbers. We talk about people who are staying with friends and family, the Department of Education counts the number of students who are homeless in our public education system, and they've counted about 2 million was the last count, children only.
We should explain to people that the Department of Education uses different criteria for who is homeless. It almost doesn't overlap at all with the HUD criteria. So these people who are doubled up and it has a big impact on education, have to move a lot from relative to relative or wherever, it's a bad thing, but they're not even considered homeless by HUD.
That's correct. Someone who is staying with friends and family, staying with a motel, not interacting with homeless services, perhaps, staying in their car, you know, just a place where they're not found easily or they're not, pointed out as homeless during the point in time counts, are not counted. So, you know, we have a point in time count from HUD that's saying this is how many homeless people there are. We have 500,000 homeless people. And that's not the case. You know, if you look at the HUD numbers only, they'll also tell you the number of shelter beds that are available, and there are actually 500,000, a little bit over, formerly homeless people who are staying in permanent supportive housing. These folks aren't even counted in, even though their housing is being covered by
they're not on their own really
programs.
Yet. Right?
Yeah, I mean they're staying in apartments mostly, and that are voucher based a lot, but they're all funded by homeless services. Those vouchers are funded by the HUD homeless programs, but they are not counted as
in
homeless.
That, okay.
So, even if we look at HUD numbers, that's at least 1 million people who are homeless or recently formerly homeless.
Thank you for that. Amanda, can you give us a brief profile of, you had 20, 30 people in that community, still do, I guess?
Right now, I've got about 15.
Okay.
We had upwards of 50 at a time, and right now I've got about 30 wanting to come to camp. But until we know what we're going to face with the city, I'm not expanding yet. The city has gone ahead and given papers to the landowner stating that they filed in court, so that's going to be our next. Yep.
And can you tell us just briefly, I mean, who these people are? Are they all men? Are they all women? Are they women and children? Are they what are these people? Who are these people?
I don't allow anyone under 18 in my camp, although I have had several single mothers at different times come up looking for a place for her and her children. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to accept them. We have women. We have men. We have veterans, we have elderly, we have drug addicts, we have people who are just trying to get enough rent to make, or enough money to make their deposit for rent. Mm. You know, I've had people stay as little as 3 days. I've had people, you know, stay from the beginning.
Okay, that number to call in again, thank you for that, is 866-LEFT-OUT, which is 866-533-8688. And we do want to take another call here. We have Barbara from D.C. Barbara, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Yes, I would like to find out, do they have to have a home in order to vote?
No. The law says no, you don't. But nobody really makes it easy either. It's hard to vote when you're homeless because you have to show where your district is or where you are, and then they'll ask you questions. And there are obstacles in front of it, but constitutionally, you still have a vote.
It actually, it depends on your community, but
yeah. Well, tell us, Megan.
A lot of homeless don't have IDs in order to get voter registration. One thing that we're starting in our community is we've got several different groups gathering together now so that we can start getting more people registered to vote.
Well, good for you. Good for you. You're in D.C., so you're working on a voter registration drive among the homeless?
I was concerned about where they go to get IDs so they can prove that they are citizens of the United States.
Right. Okay, so that's you, Barbara. Amanda, you're working on the voter ID issue.
Right.
Okay. Let me tell you both the story really quick, which is that when we did this broadcast from Mississippi after Katrina, people had lost everything. They had no IDs, and there were a lot of them, and it was a desperate situation. And if I had been running the government, one of the first things I would have done would have been to set up little government kiosks with computers and everything to help restore people's IDs. And this was something the government did not do. To get aid, you had to have four forms of ID, like a bill from a store you had shopped at to show where your residence had been, but the store was washed away and you couldn't get them. So this business about IDs is something that they have left a lot of people to suffer without IDs, and it's a very serious problem, and it's just one of the gazillion problems that are not right now being addressed. Barbara, do you have a last comment or something you'd like to make?
I just wanted to know if they, where you pay your taxes, Internal Revenue. Don't they have a list of names and IDs for people?
It's, you know, it's hard to get. If you've lost your actual Social Security card, if you don't have access to your actual birth certificate, even though those have been filed with the government, it's next to impossible to get those things replaced. You have to go through so much documentation. It costs hundreds of dollars. You have to go back and forth to these offices.
And if you don't have an address to get mail at, that makes it even more difficult.
Or transportation.
Barbara, thank you very much for the call. You asked some good questions. Penny, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Because I've asked this, and I want to ask this pretty much a lot of people, you know. In the shelter you were in, what percentage of the people in that shelter that you were in would you say were good people, and what percentage would you say bad people? Your definition, you know, people I should be afraid of if I ran into them, and what percentage were good, hardworking, or decent people would give you something?
Well, I'm not sure how many people were working, you know, because...
Well, never mind the work. How many people should I be afraid of? Terrible. There are terrible people. And I wouldn't want my kids to hang out with them. Maybe, and how many of them are good people?
Maybe about a third.
Are sketchy, you're saying.
Yeah.
But two-thirds you think are decent people.
Yeah. This is all back in the 90s. Now, maybe it might be a little higher, you know.
Because a lot more kind of innocent people are losing their housing now, right? But basically, you're here to say they're not all bad people, right?
Oh, no.
And Amanda, let me ask the same thing of you. What do you feel that you have any people there are bad people, or is it a mix? What have you encountered dealing with homeless people?
I can't say that I've got one that I would consider bad. Overall, I would say less than a quarter of the people that I encounter regularly would I consider bad, or someone that, you know, you wouldn't want to walk in a dark alley with.
Okay, fair enough. Now, you, in your situation, though, you've helped these people get housing, I mean, a tent housing, but a community of some sort. Has it been your experience that every day there's a knife fight, every day there's some...
Oh, gosh, no. Oh, gosh, no. Even what we call the drunk alley, for lack of a better term, but it's where a lot of the fights happen. It's where a lot of people spend the day drinking and stuff like that. They don't even have fights like that every day. You know, overall... You know, you're always going to have your people who instigate things, whether it be fueled by alcohol, depression, rage, drugs, whatever. You know, but really those are very few and far between. And for, you know, the advocate or the volunteer who's just trying to help them, they don't want to take advantage of that. You know, they're people with feelings same as you and I. And... Mm-hmm. generally, when people are good to us, we'll be good back.
Would you say you've seen a community? I mean, do these people in your tent city, which you've set up, and you're not a PhD in tent cities. You're somebody who's hands-on. You've learned from experience there. Do you see them as being mutually supportive of each other? Is there a community developing, or are they still isolated from each other? How has that gone?
It's developed into a community. Whenever I first came across the iSouth camp,
5 minutes.
It was a scary place to go. I certainly wouldn't have gone there at night.
Mm-hmm.
And people really, it was more of an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, mind your own business. But since they have come to Christchurch camp, they have developed into this brotherhood, this community bond of helping each other and helping me to make sure camp is running well. You know, they care about the impression that we give to the public, because they understand that a few bad seeds has caused so many of them to look bad. And that's one of the things that we're trying to change, is that perception. Mm-hmm. Because they're all just like you and I. All of them.
Penny, I
even
see you
shaking. Even the ones with bad attitudes.
Uh-huh. Which may change. If you've been on the streets, it's easy to have a bad attitude when you've been getting kicked like a dog. Penny,
exactly.
I see you nodding your head in agreement. Tell us what you're thinking.
Oh, yeah. I've definitely experienced a lot of good and a lot of positive people. You know, we are like family, you know, when the shelters that I've been in, you know. I remember coming home one night. It was like my first month or two back in 1990, and I hear the girls saying, "Hey, there she is, you know, where you been?" And I told them, and they told me that somebody ran up in the shelter, you know, "Hey, you know that white lady with the blonde hair got jumped outside." They thought it was me, and they came out there to take up for me. And when I got an understanding that they were there like that for me, I just started crying. And they asked me why I'm crying, and I told them, I said, "Nobody's really been there like that for me."
And so you've experienced that from homeless people.
Oh, yeah.
What you didn't get from housed people.
Yeah. You know, I've experienced more respect, more love, more acceptance from people that were homeless than I had, and even in family.
You're not the first person who's told me this. And Amanda, you're agreeing with that, right?
Absolutely.
You know, I remember getting a birthday cake from the women in my cube when I stayed at CC&B many years ago. You know, it was just, you know, a wonderful feeling, you know, being having that kind of love, you know.
Now, I have to point out, Amanda, that the kind of situation you've got there with some tents on some land, this is the primal situation of humanity. Before we had high-rises and things like that, right? We had teepees on the plain. We had longhouses. We had Mongolian yurts. We had things where... But that's what human beings do, is they form communities, and sometimes out of very limited structures, but that's what our species does. And in Amarillo, they're making that kind of illegal. That kind of just strikes me as odd.
They are absolutely making it illegal. There is no sleeping on public property between noon and five, or between midnight and 5 or 6 a.m. You know, now they're saying you can't camp on private property for longer than 72 hours. And in Amarillo, that includes RVs and fifth wheels. So if you've got your in-laws staying out in front of your house in their fifth wheel for longer than 72 hours, they can give you up to a $2,000 a day fine per person per violation.
Which, if you're homeless, of course, you take out of your back pocket, right? That kind of money, right?
Well,
right. Amanda, let me thank you very much for participating in the Homelessness Marathon. We're running out of time, but let me also just express my hope that you'll be able to keep your tent city together, and my admiration for you as a housed person who has pitched in and helped out. So I want to thank you very much.
And I'd like to thank you for doing what you're doing, too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I appreciate you both.
Thank you. Megan, tell us, we've only got a minute or two left. Why don't you tell us exactly what does the National Coalition for the Homeless want to see happen?
Well, we want to see the government step up. We can afford as a country, to provide housing for everyone in this country. We can afford the basic necessities that we all need as humans. And so that's what I really like to see. You know, the root cause of all homelessness is a lack of affordable housing. So, you know,
30 seconds.
A fairly simple thing to do.
All right. Well, we're out of time. Megan Hustings, interim director of the National Coalition for the Homeless.
Thank you.
And Penny Callen, speaker advocate. Thank you both for participating in the Homelessness Marathon. We'll be back in just a few seconds.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon, originating from WPFW in Washington, D.C. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the participating organizations or the originating and affiliated radio stations.
From the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Listener supported, now commercial radio.
Took the land from the people who were here before them, and we're trying to get back what land belongs to America.
Hey, this is Parisa, the host of Taking Action, but today we're really excited to be here as part of the Homelessness Marathon broadcast on Pacifica Radio Network, and we're coming to you live from WPFW in Washington, D.C., 89.3 FM, and I'm really excited to be in the studio with some champions of the D.C. community, people who are not afraid to speak up and speak out about the situation taking place in the city here with regards to housing issues, homelessness, and human rights. So let me take this chance to introduce you to Jewel Strowman and her husband Antonio.